From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, new ideas being floated as ways to raise money to fix the roads, including
the possibility to allow counties and even some larger cities the ability to levy their own local gas taxes and even vehicle registration fees.
The plant called Kratom, you can buy it at a gas station, and yes, it could get you high.
It doesn't have the potency that more stronger opiates would, you know, such as fentanyl, heroin, or morphine. But we do know that it does stimulate the mu opioid receptors.
What we should know about Kratom, plus the Michigan astronaut inspired to go into space when he watched the moonwalk 50 years ago.
And I said, Dad, I want to be an astronaut someday. And he said, Jerry, this is America. You work hard, study hard, be anything you set your mind to.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we will mark the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 as we talk with Michigan astronaut Jerry Lininger, inspired to become an astronaut after watching Neil Armstrong take man's first step onto the moon.
It's a profound, life-changing experience, at least for me, when I ventured out into space.
That comes later in the program. But first, state lawmakers are on their summer recess, but GOP lawmakers are still cooking up ideas to pay for road repairs, ideas that do not include Governor Whitmer's proposed 45-cent a gallon gas tax hike. Lindsay Van Hulley from Bridge Magazine is here to walk us through one of these new ideas. Lindsay, the legislature's off for the summer. There's no budget, no roads deal. And October 1, that budget deadline is not that far away. So the clock is ticking.
It really is. And, you know, we don't have a lot of insight yet into what will be part of the final proposal that both the House and the Senate are going to come up with that ultimately counters what the governor has put forward. But what we're seeing are some ideas that are beginning to swirl as lawmakers are home talking to constituents at town hall meetings. And a few of those actually came from Representative Jack O'Malley from Lake Ann. And he is a first-term legislator and chairman of the House Transportation Committee. And throughout the spring, his committee has held a number of hearings that he called Road Building 101, looking at ways to build roads, to generate revenue locally, different kinds of ideas around those concepts. And so talking with him recently, he shared that one of the ideas that he is interested in looking at are the possibility to allow counties and even some larger cities the ability to levy their own local gas taxes and even vehicle registration fees.
I'm wondering how much money that might raise. And would that money go into like a state kitty, or would it be used locally to fix local roads?
You know, there's a lot of those details, I think, that we don't know yet. A number of those questions are still out there. And so one thing he shared with me is that, you know, this could be potentially up to a nickel, although I think there's no definitive amount of a local gas tax yet that has been decided on. But there are a number of questions from, you know, how would the revenue be dedicated? Would it be strictly for roads? And how would it be distributed? Would it stay in the county or the city where it's generated? You know, would the state collect it and disperse it to local governments through sort of a revenue sharing model, or would local governments collect it directly? I think those are a lot of things that are still unknown, and it's not even certain yet that this proposal will ultimately be part of a final plan from the legislature, but it's certainly one option that at least some Republican lawmakers are interested in looking at.
Do we know if this has been done in other states?
It has, actually. About 11 states across the country authorized the collection of local gas taxes. Another 33 allow local governments to charge local vehicle registration fees. And Michigan right now is not among either of those.
Certainly the idea of giving local governments more freedom to tax is kind of unusual for Michigan. As we see in your story for Bridge, Michigan's one of the most restrictive states in the country when it comes to giving local governments the opportunity to lever their own taxes. So why this and why now?
Well, it's an option. I think that local government groups have looked at, you know, even beyond the local gas tax and vehicle registration fees, there's been discussions among municipal groups about looking at local sales taxes as well, which Michigan also doesn't authorize. Just one of nine states that doesn't allow local governments to collect their own local sales taxes. And part of that is just the pressure that the property tax is under. As we all know, the property values collapsed quickly with the recession, but they're limited and how fast they can grow. And so as the economy has recovered, property values haven't grown at the same rate that they fell. And so that's put a lot of pressure on the ability of local governments to generate revenue. And so when you're looking at not just road repairs, but other local government operations, the question becomes, are there ways that we can give more options to local governments, you know, to be able to collect revenue for other kinds of operations or other kinds of services that might, you know, put a little bit less pressure on the property tax millage?
Lindsay, a cynic might just say, the Lansing Republicans don't want that tax blood on their hands. Oh, let's let the local governments do it. Is that a fair take?
You know, I don't know that that's something that I've necessarily heard. I think, you know, it's difficult, again, to sort of know how this is going to all play out, whether some kind of tax increase, whether it's a state gas tax, whether it's a local gas tax, whether some combination, how that looks in a final compromise, I think, is yet to be seen.
Any idea what kind of traction this idea is getting in Lansing, or is it just too early at this point?
I think it's too early. You know, I put the question to the legislative leadership, and you know, they've acknowledged that, you know, these are a lot of kind of options for smarter long-term planning that have come out of the committee. But again, nothing is final. And so even Representative O'Malley himself said, you know, he would love if some of these ideas make it into the final version. But even he's not sure how many of them will finally end up on the table.
Lindsay Van Holly, Bridge Magazine. Great talking with you.
Thanks. Same to you.
Michigan is not the only state contemplating a hike in the cost of a gallon of gasoline. Several other states have gas tax increases kicking in this summer. We're going to talk about why and look at how other states are handling their tax hikes as we talk to Carl Davis. He's a research director at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Carl, good to have you with us. How many other Midwestern states are considering or have already implemented an increase in gasoline taxes?
I mean, over the last few years, basically all of them have considered an increase. And just this summer, we were seeing increases implemented in Ohio and Illinois. Before that, it was Indiana and Iowa. A couple years before that, there was a very significant increase in Pennsylvania. We're seeing a lot of this in the Midwest. We're seeing a lot of this around the country, really. I mean, more than 30 states have implemented gas tax increases since the recession, starting in 2013, this is when this trend really kicked off.
So explain why this trend is kind of happening. Why so many states at this one point in time?
Well, I mean, some of it's playing catch up. The thing about the gas tax is when you write a fixed number of cents per gallon into the tax law, you know that over time you're going to have to revisit that because that number becomes outdated. I mean, back when gas taxes were first implemented, they were a penny or two per gallon. And, you know, you wouldn't be able to fund a modern infrastructure with that kind of gas tax rate. A lot of these states have been playing catch up. They let their rates get very outdated. The other thing that's going on is the federal government has let its gas tax get tremendously outdated. It's been more than 26 years since the federal gas tax went up. That's the longest we've ever gone at the federal level. And so that means there's less federal money for transportation and states are having to pick up the slack.
So states certainly didn't weren't in a position during the depths of the recession to go and, hey, by the way, we're going to raise taxes. So as you say, they're playing catch up. And it certainly seems that we who pump the gas, we consumers, we've gotten a little spoiled.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, most drivers' knee-jerk reaction is to oppose things that are going to raise the price of gas. I mean, I enjoy paying less rather than more for gas. I understand that. But at the same time, you know, roads and bridges aren't free. And at a certain point, if you're hitting potholes and routinely having to get your car realigned, or if you're stuck in traffic, or heaven forbid, driving over bridges that are unsafe, and we've seen some really terrible collapses in the last few years. I mean, these kind of things aren't worth paying a super low gas tax rate for. And at some point, it's just worth it to pay a bit more for a smoother and a safer commute.
Governor Whitmer is proposing a 45-cent a gallon increase. Illinois, I believe, was 19-cent hike. Ohio, 10-cent hike. Can you help us understand why Michigan's is such a large increase compared to some of these other states?
Yeah, 45 cents is definitely significant. With Michigan's climate, the freeze-thaw cycle definitely takes a toll on roads and bridges. So there's a lot of repair work that has to be done around that. So it's possible that some other states are using more general fund money to fund transportation. you know, if you don't get it out of the gas tax, then you have to get it out of somewhere else. So are you going to pay a higher income tax rate, which is actually quite low in Michigan, or a higher sales tax rate, or higher registration fees? The money has to come from somewhere. The case being made here is that it should be a gas tax increase. And the general argument for that is there's a pretty good link between what you pay in gas tax and how much benefit you get out of the road. So if you're driving a whole lot, or if you're driving a really heavy vehicle that's inflicting a lot of wear and tear on the roads, then you're typically going to pay more gas tax. The other benefit of the gas tax is you're able to get money out of state drivers, tourists, visitors, out of trucking companies as well. So it's a way to make sure everybody who's using the roads are chipping in to maintain them and to improve them.
In our state, our current fuel tax doesn't just go to roads. It also contributes to the state's K-12 education budget. As we kind of think about how other states divvy up their gas tax revenue, is that unusual to have some of that money go to K-12?
Yeah, it's a little unusual. It's not unprecedented. We see this in Texas and Illinois and Hawaii as well. The idea here is Michigan's general sales tax does apply to gasoline. So it's the same tax you're going to pay if you're buying furniture or toothpaste or anything else. You know, generally, economists tend to favor making your sales tax base really broad. It should apply to everything that people are buying, or at least to a broad set of things that people are buying. And Michigan's doing that with applying its general sales tax. It's unusual, but not unique in doing that.
We have a political split in our state, as you know, a Democratic governor, a GOP legislature. I'm wondering, especially these other Midwest states, what about those states? How do these kind of political dynamics impact the ability of a state to push a fuel tax hike through?
So much of tax policy can be highly partisan. And oddly enough, the gas tax hasn't been. We've seen states under full Democratic control and under full Republican control enact gas tax increases. It's been a little less common to see states under split control do so, although we did just see one in New Jersey not too long ago. So Michigan's most recent gas tax increase was enacted when both the legislature and the governor were Republicans. Obviously, that's changed since then. So now you're having to see some working across the aisle to make it happen. So there's potentially a little more friction there in getting it across the finish line. But you know, big picture, this hasn't really been a partisan issue nationwide.
Giving us a sense of the gas tax landscape in this country, Carl Davis, who is Research Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Carl, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up, there's been a crackdown on prescription opioids as overdose deaths continue to rise. But some people have found an alternative in a widely available and legal drug. We'll learn about kratom and its potential health impacts after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called Kratom. You can buy it at gas stations, buy it online. No prescription needed in Michigan. And there are two widely different views of this plant. It's a mood enhancer, a pain reliever, perhaps a viable substitute to dangerous opioids, or it's dangerous, it's addictive, it needs to be regulated. So let's talk about this as we learn more about kratom and whether it should be regulated in Michigan. Here with us is Dr. Edward Juni. He's with the University of Michigan Addiction Treatment Services. So good to have you with us, doctor.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So first of all, what is kratom?
So kratom is a plant. It is indigenous to Southeast Asia, and it's been used for a long time. The reason why it's gained so much attention is because some of the contents of this plant are pharmacologically active and produce a wide spectrum of psychotropic effects.
They act on the brain.
Yeah.
So what are some of the claims being made about kratom from people who've used it, and what do they say it does for them?
So there's multiple claims, and these are predominantly on social media, YouTube. There's a lot of YouTubers, and there's other people that are pro-kratom that are conveying multiple therapeutic benefits, including pain relief, including a mild stimulant type of effect, euphoria, antidepressant effects, also an anxiolytic effect, which means basically anti-anxiety. So there's a multitude of different therapeutic benefits that have been conveyed out there.
And there has been this narrative that it could be a viable substitute for opioids?
Correct. That's a claim that has also been perpetuated, yep.
Do we know how it acts on the brain?
Well, we know that it stimulates the opioid receptors to at least a mild extent. It certainly doesn't have the potency that more stronger opiates would, you know, such as fentanyl, heroin, or morphine. But we do know that it does stimulate the mu opioid receptors.
So when you hear people saying that that Kratom does this array of things for them, do you feel these are valid claims?
I think some of them are valid, sure. I think there's no question that this plant does contain pharmacologically active compounds, and these drugs do possess psychotropic capabilities. And certainly the claims that are out there with respect to the subjective claims, meaning that the mild stimulant type of effect, possible analgesic or pain relief effects, I think there's probably some truth to that. But we need to be careful and make a distinction between subjective effects versus therapeutic efficacy, and then calling something a treatment. Because something produces a subjective effect doesn't necessarily translate into that this is an objective or an evidence-based treatment modality.
Because that takes scientific
Correct. So that study. Takes research, that takes studies, that takes taking people, assessing them beforehand, assessing them afterwards, assessing their functionality beforehand, and making an assessment with an improvement in function afterwards. And with this compound, you know, with this plant, with the pharmaceuticals that are within this plant, unfortunately, we know very, very little about that. You know, what we do know is what is being subjectively claimed on social media and on YouTube and on the various websites that actually sell this. You know, they're setting forth claims out there. But I think what we're lacking is any objective scientific research that definitively states without any ambiguity that this is actually producing a therapeutic benefit.
And the FDA says avoid it totally. The DEA was talking about adding Kratom to its Schedule I controlled substance list. That was in 2016. And then it kind of backed away and said we need to do more research into that. But six states and Washington, D.C. have banned Kratom.
Yeah.
So what are the concerns?
Well, the concerns are is that, number one, is that this is something that has not been studied enough. Certainly, if you have something that hasn't been studied, that really doesn't make it ominous in itself. I think there's two things. The first thing I just mentioned, it hasn't been studied. But then the second thing is that some of the properties that this substance has, and namely, is that it stimulates the opioid receptor system. So this receptor system is very powerful, and compounds that traditionally stimulate this system are highly addictive in nature. And that
as we know from the opioid
correct,
epidemic.
And that would include traditional opioids such as morphine, hydrocodone, some of the synthetic opioids such as fentanyl. So what behaviors is this substance going to elicit? And I think in a vulnerable population, this can elicit compulsive utilization.
Addiction.
Correct. And I think that is the concern, is that this could be a potentially addictive substance. And that's something that I think healthcare providers should be potentially concerned with. And again, the other thing is that we're dealing with something that has not been studied, and at least to the best of my knowledge, is not regulated. So you have a plant that possesses quite potent pharmacologically active substances, but where is it produced? What are the quality control measures? When it's being sold, you know, who are the vendors? Who are selling it? And do they have any standards? So it's not regulated as a drug. When something is identified by the Food and Drug Administration as a drug, that sets forth a whole set of regulatory procedures, quality control measures, and unfortunately, we don't have that with this. So when you're buying it, when you're going to a gas station or when you're going to wherever and you're buying this, what are you buying? What are the ingredients? What is the purity? And are there any oversights to ensure that what it says on the package is actually what you're actually ingesting? So there's all these concerns. And if they were selling orange juice, right, it wouldn't be that much of a concern. But again, you are selling something that has very potent pharmacologically active properties and also tickles the mu opioid receptors.
And so we know the state of Michigan is considering regulating Kratom and making companies test it for quality and impurity and also list it on a label. It sounds like from what you're saying, that you think would be a good step.
I think it would be a good step, but I think an even better step would be is that let's look at this. Let's see what it does. Let's see if there's any therapeutic benefit to it. And if there's any potential medicinal qualities to this, I think that has to be looked at. But right now, we just don't know. And the unknown can be potentially harmful. And so I think that we need to be cautious.
What do you want people listening to us talking about this to know about kratom, and particularly parents who may have kids going into a gas station and picking up these capsules?
I think that when you're hearing information being perpetuated, I think that they need to scrutinize the source. And that's really what I would tell them. So if you're hearing claims that this is an antidepressant or that it's, you know, alleviating pain, I think you need to scrutinize where that information is actually coming from. So that's one. And I think the second thing is that they need to be aware that, you know, this is something that has the potential to be quite powerful, you know, both in biological terms as well as in psychological terms. And you have a propensity towards potential addictive behavior. And that's something that needs to be considered as well. Now, certainly the majority of the claims that are floating around there are that this is mild. You know, people say it's, you know, no different than drinking a cup of coffee. And for some people, it may certainly have that effect. But I think in a vulnerable population, I think that it has the potential to be harmful. Again, just because of the inherent nature of the drug's properties.
How worried are you that there it is sitting out on the counter at the gas station?
Well, I'm not worried about everybody. I'm worried about a small subset of people that have a vulnerability or a susceptibility towards what we call in the business a substance use disorder. There are some individuals that are predisposed to using potentially euphoric substances in a compulsive manner. And if they're exposing their central nervous system to a drug that stimulates the mu opioid receptor, that could potentially precipitate addictive behaviors. Now, I'm not saying that the utilization of this is harmful to everybody that comes across it, because that's simply not the case. We're talking about a subgroup of individuals who have a vulnerability towards substance use disorders. And I think utilizing something that is not regulated, where there's very minimal quality control measures, and a substance that does have opioid-like properties, I think it's dangerous, and I think we need to be mindful of that.
Dr. Edward Juni with University of Michigan's Addiction Treatment Services, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on and issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history. It began May 25, 1961, when President John F. Kennedy issued this challenge.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space. And none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
It was difficult. It was expensive. But the challenge was met 8 years later on July 16, 1969, with the launch of the first manned mission to the moon, Apollo 11.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Astronauts Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins rode that Saturn V rocket into space. 4 days later, July 20th, Armstrong and Aldrin carefully piloted the lunar module Eagle onto the lunar surface.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
And then came man's first footstep on the moon. Here's Walter Cronkite covering that historic moment for CBS.
There he is. There's a foot coming down the steps. Armstrong is on the moon. Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American. Standing on the surface of the moon on this July 20th, 1969.
That's one small step for man, by a fleet for me.
Today on Stateside, we mark this 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. We're going to find out how that moon landing inspired Michigander Jerry Lininger to become an astronaut. He'll talk about living and working in space. But first, a Michigan connection to that long effort that led to the U.S. space program. Did you know that as early as 1933, Willard Dow and the Dow Chemical Company were already working on early space travel and research? Joining us now to tell us about this very early entry into the space race is education specialist with the Michigan History Center, Rachel Clark. So, Rachel, everyone knows about the 1960s space race and certainly the eventual moon landing and walk. Tell us how Willard Dow got involved in space research in 1933. Was it really outer space?
It wasn't quite outer space, but it was as close as we had gotten at that point. So in 1933, or in the early 30s, Willard Dow had taken over Dow Company. And prior to that, in the late 1890s, Herbert Dow had been kind of looking into magnesium alloys. And Willard sort of continued that. So in 1933, the University of Chicago, they were very interested in studying cosmic rays in outer space. They knew that they were there, but not much else about them. And they wanted to get into the stratosphere, which the stratosphere is quite, it sounds really huge, but it goes up from about 30,000 feet to about 165,000 feet.
No, 1933, that was huge.
That is huge. So they wanted to get up into the stratosphere to study those rays. And they wanted to go up in a balloon gondola and take them into the stratosphere. And they approached Dow with this idea.
So what did Dow do? What was the role in the research?
So they had been working on this magnesium alloy that had been developed and called Dow metal. And that came out in the early 1900s, actually 1916, I believe. And people were sort of meh. Companies weren't really interested in it because you had aluminum that was already being used. It was already being produced. So why switch to something else? And so Dow had this magnesium alloy that they had been developing and looking for a use for it. And when the University of Chicago approached them, they already sort of had this material that they were very interested in trying out as Dow metal. So Willard Dow put a team together to start building this gondola.
And what was the whole point? Where was the gondola going to be used? What kind of flight was it supposed to have?
The gondola was going to be attached to a balloon to go up into the stratosphere, and then they would use instruments to study, again, the cosmic rays that were in outer space, or they were going to try to. They really, I don't know that they, I'm not a scientist, clearly.
Sure.
I don't know what they thought they were going to be able to do.
But the World's
but
Fair
they wanted
was
to get
involved.
Up there.
The World's
it
Fair.
It was.
Yeah.
They tied the introduction of this to the World's Fair. So what they ended up doing was finishing it. The gondola was finished in late spring of 1933, and in June, it was shipped actually to Akron, Ohio. It was going to be attached to a balloon that Goodyear was making for the gondola toward five cities between Midland and Akron. And then it was moving on to the Century of Progress Fair in Chicago, where it was going to be launched. So there's all sorts of sort of this really huge display of this. And the Chicago World's Fair was where it was going to be.
So much attention paid to that World's Fair that year in Chicago. So was this going to be an unmanned flight or was someone going up in this gondola?
They were going to be manned. Originally, it was going to be a gentleman named Jean Picard. He was a University of Chicago scientist, along with a Navy pilot. But at the last minute, Picard decided to give up his seat because he wanted as little weight in the gondola as possible. So he gave up his seat, and it was just the Navy pilot that went up.
So off it went, to 3 a.m. on August 5th, 1933. How did the flight go?
It didn't go great. It went up. It launched. 25,000 people were watching the balloon launch. It got up to about 5,000 feet, and then it crashed. The initial flight wasn't as successful as everyone was hoping, but it wasn't considered really a failure. So they sort of went back to the drawing board and started again and gave it another couple shots.
And we should probably clarify, how did the Navy commander fare?
He was okay. Everyone was fine. There were no injuries. The gondola survived. It was actually in really good shape, which says a lot. You know, if you're in a plummet to the earth from 5,000 feet, then obviously this Dow metal, it stood that that impact. And so that says a lot about the Dow metal. The fact that the pilot was unharmed, I think he had a couple bumps and bruises, but then the gondola also survived. So that's why, although the flight didn't succeed, and it did crash back down to the Earth. It was a success because
it was a crash test. and exactly how high did it get?
It got up to about 5,000 feet.
So as you say, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Mm-hmm. And they did. How did it go in subsequent flights?
So they go up a couple more times. 1934, they get up to about 61,000 feet. So they redesign everything and get up there. And then in 35, they do it again. This time they just want to study the stratosphere. They're moving their focus, and they actually get up to about 72,400 feet in that flight. That is also Navy pilots that are manning the gondola and the balloon. And those are considered very successful and actually lead to Dow to helping with war production 6 years later as the United States gets into World War II.
But you stop and you think that these early pilots aboard this gondola built with Dow metal, they are the forefathers of the Mercury astronauts, the Apollo astronauts, and onward.
They are. They're the first really sort of big test pilots that you're seeing that are becoming part of that program.
The story of Michigan's early role in the very, very early stages of the space race. Thanks to Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Michigan astronaut Jerry Leninger remembers his missions aboard the space shuttles Discovery and Atlantis and the Russian space station Mir.
Seeing, you know, literally thousands and thousands of stars and knowing that there's billions and even trillions of them out there, even trillions of galaxies. And it makes you feel so small.
We'll talk with Jerry Leninger next on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 50 years ago this week, America crowded around TV sets watching Neil Armstrong take man's first step onto the moon. And that included a kid from East Detroit named Jerry Leninger. That moonwalk inspired him to become an astronaut with missions aboard two U.S. space shuttles, as well as the Russian space station Mir, traveling some 54 million miles in space. Today, he's retired in northern Michigan. Jerry Leninger, good to talk with you again. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Good to be back with you.
Well, here we are saying, how did this happen? 50 years, the anniversary of Apollo 11. Jerry, take us back to July 1969. And what do you most remember about watching Neil Armstrong take that first step onto the lunar surface?
You know, I was a 14-year-old kid. I was on a camping trip up in Canada, looking up at the moon. And I said, you know, our guys are up there. I told my brother, Ken, our guys are up there. That's incredible. And we made our way back to the general campground, and someone had an old-fashioned generator and a black and white TV sitting on the picnic table. And every camper in the area was gathered around that. And I can remember Walter Cronkite, you know, choking up with a tear in his eye, saying, man on the moon. And then he ripped his glasses off and, you know, wiped a tear from his eye. And I said, man, we are doing something fabulous here. The whole world is watching. Walter Cronkite is crying. I want to do that someday. And so that inspired the living daylights out of me. Went home, Blue Cotter neighborhood, Detroit. Dad drove a telephone truck, five kids in the family. And I said, Dad, I want to be an astronaut someday. And he said, Jerry, this is America. You work hard, study hard, be anything you set your mind to.
And you did.
Yeah. And that, you know, so that moment inspired me, as I'm sure it's inspired many people. And even now, 50 years, you know, later, it still inspires us. We still, when something's difficult, we say, hey, we landed a man on the moon. We can do that. And so I think that there's those intangibles it gives you besides the tangibles.
And I know you joined the Navy, you went to medical school at Wayne State, and then in August 1992, you became a member of Astronaut Selection Group 14 and launched into space your first time September 9th, 1994, aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery. What is it
Yahoo!
Like? Tell us what
Yahoo!
That's like.
14 years old, and then I'm launching to space. So the dream realized. And half of Michigan was at that launch because it was a January launch. So they all went to Florida and were poolside while I was out on that rocket. And, you know, what a thrill. It's just, you know, raw power, incredible power, about 7 million pounds of thrust. And to put that in perspective, the Apollo rockets were closer to 8 million pounds of thrust. And to put that into today's perspective, you know, the Falcon Heavy, the big rocket that we talk about now, the biggest rocket out there, is about 5 million pounds of thrust. So 8 million for the Apollo, 5 million for the one we have now. it tells you, you know, that was a heck of an accomplishment back in, you know, using 1960s technology. We had the Saturn V rocket, which had five nozzles, five engines, essentially, for the primary stage, where now we have to strap together 27 rocket engines to try to, you know, get even close to that much power. So, you know, it's incredible what they did back then.
And for you as one of a handful, I mean, fewer than 600 of you can, you know, in human history can say we went into space. Is there any sense of what did I get myself into and I'm afraid, or was it Yahoo?
It was Yahoo. On the other hand, during the launch, you are just focused, concentrating, making sure you're not letting your teammates down. And in my case, I was telling myself, I'm not letting my organization down, United States Navy, going to represent them well. And also kind of more broadly saying I'm representing mankind. So during the actual, you know, 7 minutes to get to orbit of utter chaos and acceleration and fireball and, you know, everything else, sound wave just beating through you like a bass drum, you are just focused, you know, doing your job, making sure you're not, you know, moving the wrong switch at the wrong time. And then after the engines cut off, I actually had a job right away to float into the window and take a photo of the external tank before it moved too far away. But after I did that, then I finally, you know, caught my breath. And then sort of an instant replay in my mind of the actual thrill of it all and the, you know, felt the whole thing. And that's when my heart raced and that's when my pulse shot up and I, you know, started sweating and started just screaming Yahoo. But during the phase, you couldn't afford to do that. So you compartmentalize that video sort of in your mind and then immediate replay it. And I saw the same in all my crewmates and we're just, you know, hugging each other and everybody's screaming and yeah, we're in space.
And you look back and you see Earth from space. What's your memory of that first view?
You know, it's just awesome. You're looking at the planet as a whole. You feel, you know, it makes you feel big because you're like this godlike view of creation. And then on the other hand, I'd be on the dark side of the earth sometimes looking out into the universe and seeing, you know, literally thousands and thousands of stars and knowing that there's billions and even trillions of them out there, even trillions of galaxies. And it makes you feel so small. And so you've got the extremes, you know, making you feel big and making you feel like a dot in the universe simultaneously almost. So it's a profound, life-changing experience, at least for me, when I ventured out into space.
And then you ventured out again, only in a different way. You trained to be a cosmonaut, you learned Russian, and you were on board the Russian space station Mir. You think of this intense race to the moon between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and there you are, aboard Mir. It was a real new chapter in space history, wasn't it?
Da, konnichiwa.
Yeah,
myself and two Russians, they speak no English. You're pretty much controlled by Mission Control in Moscow. It was, I would say, if God were looking down on us, he wouldn't know which one was the American. So I was there to learn the Russian ways, to learn how they had, you know, accomplished the things they did in long-duration space flight, and to get us ready to build the International Space Station. So I guess a bit of a guinea pig, if you will, and just kind of threw me out there. 2 years in Russia, learning the language, 5 months in space. And that's a whole different experience than the much more compact shuttle flight where everything's kind of mapped out. Here, you're just trying to stay on an even keel, try to get 120 different experiments done. Had a failing space station, so trying to keep that space station alive, design life 3 to 5 years, and it was about 13 years old. So you learned a lot from that. And it reminds me, you know, even back in the Apollo days with the Apollo 1 fire, we lose three of our astronauts, Grissom, Chafee, and White. Chafee and White, I think, have ties to the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. But after that, you know, we designed new materials, and now firefighters today use those materials.
And you certainly tested them because you had the most severe fire ever aboard an orbiting spacecraft, and you survived it.
That's true. And that's a scary moment, trust me. You're up there cut off, isolated, and you've got flames 3 or 4 feet in length, blowtorch-like in intensity, sparks flying, and you realize that hull is paper thin, you know, made out of aluminum. And you know if that blowtorch points down, it's going to pierce the hull, rapid decompression, quick suffocation. And so again, that's where all your professional training, my own case, you know, flying off the aircraft carriers at night, launching in rockets, all those things come to play, and you learn to, just like I was talking about during launch, you learn to compartmentalize the chaos around you and use your brain and work your way through the problem. And we methodically did that, myself, my cosmonaut crewmates, also professionals who knew what they were doing, been in some tight situations. One of them was an old MiG fighter pilot. And so, you know, you keep your cool and you survive. And then again, then you go to a sort of a dark corner of the space station, and then you go through the emotion of it, and you let those emotions out.
I'm speaking with former astronaut Jerry Leninger. This Navy veteran these days is enjoying life on the Leelanau Peninsula, but he flew aboard the space shuttle's Discovery in Atlantis and served nearly 5 months on the Russian space station Mir. I want to just play a quick little round robin here, because you hear these questions all the time, but you are one of a handful of people in history who can tell us what it is like to live in space. So I'm going to toss out a word. Give us your strongest memory or feeling. Weightlessness.
Just freedom, just floating freedom, you know, 100 somersaults in a row and a big smile on your face.
Were you good at being weightless, or did it take a little practice?
Oh, I was excellent at being weightless, but it was probably 30 days into that mission, and I saw the same sort of transformation take place in my two Russian crewmates. And when the shuttle arrived to pick me up, it was kind of like a herd of buffalo coming aboard. And these are experienced astronauts, but they are definitely not space adapted like I was. I was flying as if I, you know, had done that all my life, and I could be upside down talking to you right now, and I'd be totally comfortable. So I was three-dimensional at that point. I didn't see floors, walls, ceiling. I just saw volume. That's another little interesting aspect, is that people say, how do you live in a place, cramped like that for 5 months? But it's a little bit bigger, because, you know, you can be up on the ceiling, you can be down on the floor, you can be standing on a wall. And so you're seeing volume, and therefore I never felt sort of claustrophobic during the 5 months on a pretty small space station.
Then flipping the coin, getting back to Earth and back to gravity.
Yeah, you're heavy. Feels like you're on my shoulders the whole time. You turn your head too fast, you feel like you're doing backflips, you know, inner ear sort of maladjusted. So it's a bit of a transition to go from spaceman back to Earthling. And as a matter of fact, the bone loss I had about 12-14% bone loss, hips, lower spine. And that took me a couple years to get back to about a 2%, looks like permanent bone loss. You know, Cynthia, I just took a little bicycle ride up in the Upper Peninsula. I just took off for 6 days, about 350 miles. And I can remember distinctly that about a year and a half after my flight, I was riding my bicycle, and all of a sudden it kicked back in. Sort of that neuromuscular disconnect that I had suddenly took care of itself, and I felt normal again. So literally a year and a half after my flight, I still didn't feel quite right. And then it was just literally from one revolution to the next on that bicycle, it clicked back in, started doing 100-mile bike rides, things I'd done in the past. And then at 2 years, I was pretty much feeling back to normal. So it's a tough, you know, transition back to the Earth.
Jerry, as we are here talking to mark the 50th anniversary since the United States won the race to the moon, why does it matter that the United States was first?
You know, it was a Cold War. It was competition. I love competition. I love free enterprise. I love what happens, you know, when our private enterprise companies are up against each other. I love what's happening right now with Elon Musk and SpaceX and NASA and, you know, we got so many rockets, it's hard to keep track of them. So I love the competition. I think it brings out the best in us. And I think by challenging, like Kennedy did to us, to say we're going to get to the moon in this decade, you know, that brought out the best in all of us. So I think it's important because the United States proved that our system works, that our, you know, our liberty and our freedom, the things that our people have because we live in this great nation, you know, we can excel. And we definitely excelled during that time. Matter of fact, when I hear nowadays when they say we're going back to the moon and people right away jump saying, you know, we need to make this an international cooperation, you just can't do it by yourself. That's sort of the official line, but I'll tell you, I'm not sure I believe that.
Why?
50 years ago, the United States did it alone. You know, it's the United States flag that was on the moon. And so I'm all for cooperation. But my experience working with the Russians, I think I learned a little bit that sometimes it can be a bit of an anchor and you're sort of wasting some resources on some technology that you've already surpassed a long time ago. So I love partnerships, but not the drag of partnerships. And so someone has to contribute or just leave them behind, in my mind. And if you want to go to the moon, it's tough. So,
yeah,
you know, you got to push it. And we're pushing it now. The Artemis program just announced they want to do it by 2024 back to the moon. And that's a challenge. And everybody better be on board. And you cannot be dead weight in a program like that.
I was checking NASA's budget for fiscal year 2020. It was $21 billion, up 1.4% over the previous fiscal year, 2019. Why should we fund NASA when our nation has so many other needs? Why does space exploration by the United States of America matter to that much money?
Yeah, I think with that much money, you got the human part of that is about $3 billion of it, and they want about a $1.5 billion boost. I just say, put that number in perspective. The bailout during the recession to just one company was over $120 billion. $120 billion. And we're talking a NASA budget that is, doing all kinds of stuff besides the human spaceflight, you know, designing better aircraft, everything else, about $20 billion. So I think the nation can afford it for sure. And I guess the second point, that inspiration I talked about, I think that's important. But probably the most important thing is pushing technology. And people often ask me, you know, should we go to the moon? Should we go to Mars? Should we go to a meteor? You know, what should we go to? Some asteroid out there? It doesn't matter. The important thing is that we do something challenging and hard, and so that it brings out the best in us, and that so it keeps our technology on the cutting edge and competitive in the global competitive environment that we find ourselves. So, you know, even back to Apollo, there's so many things that happen: miniaturization of computers, miniaturization of cameras, lighter weight materials that could withstand heavy heat. A more mundane example is the launch pad, or that big Saturn V rocket with 8 million pounds of thrust really rocked that structure. And they had some basic shock absorbers along the side of that structure to withstand it so that you didn't, you know, knock the launch pad down. That same design, literally the same design, is used in bridges today. And we got the earthquakes out in California, and a lot of those bridges have those shock absorbers built into them to withstand the seismic shock of the earthquakes. And so the spinoffs are incredible. The job creation is incredible. John Young, who drove the rover on the moon, I used to have dinner at his house every Sunday night, and he said, "Jerry, I don't know what people thought. I never took sacks of money and buried them in the lunar soil. Those sacks of money went to a tool maker in Peoria, Illinois, to some guy building a nut and bolt in Detroit, Michigan. It went and paid engineers, it paid postdocs, it encouraged our universities in engineering, the things that we're trying to encourage now, the STEM fields. You know, that money was well spent. That's the kind of seed money a government should be interested in sowing, you know? That actually is creating jobs, that's actually creating prosperity for our country.
So 50 years after you sat at that campground and watched Neil Armstrong step onto the moon, what advice would you give to a kid in Michigan today harboring dreams of being part of the next wave of space exploration?
You know, study hard, man. Do things you enjoy. Realize there's no limits out there. Again, I'm a, you know, blue-collar neighborhood public school guy. Got to go into space and got to associate with some of the, you know, really elite brain power of the world. And that space program brings together that elite brain power. So, you know, set your goal, have that stretch goal out there, but make sure you have intermediate goals along the way. And if you never make it to that stretch goal because you get interested in something else along the way, it still served you well. It got you out there working hard, accomplishing things, and moving our nation forward. And back to your, you know, basic question about the finances and why is it worth it for NASA, you know, without the prosperity of this country, without people doing those job creations, the Bill Gateses creating a, you know, something like Microsoft and the hundreds of thousands of jobs created and the prosperity created, you know, we don't have the budget to do anything advanced. And it's a privilege to have that. So I guess to any young person, you know, you're in the right place at the right time, and the sky is not the limit. You know, I found out the sky is not the limit. You can go to space, and who knows where we go to next generation.
Jerry Leninger, it is always great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Always nice being on the planet with you. Appreciate it.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.